Welcome to the Reimagining Podcast with Theodore Richards. The Reimagining Podcast is a production of Wisdom Projects Incorporated, a 501c3 nonprofit organization, which includes the Baltimore Wisdom Project and the Chicago Wisdom Project. Our shared mission is to reimagine education and reimagine the world by enhancing the lives of youth and adults with holistic education, intercultural understanding, and anti-oppressive liberationist thought leadership.
It's 7 a.m. and I'm sitting on the front porch, crying. My front porch is large and screened in. If I look closely through my tears, I can see where one screen has a slightly different tone. It's new, having been replaced after someone busted through it last week in a robbery attempt. It was only one of many events that had happened last week. A car firebombed on 71st, a high-speed car chase ending in a crash on 70th, a couple of gunfights. The South Side is hurting in the pandemic. People already on the edge, pushed over in the economic collapse. The drug trade was only spurred on by mass unemployment, gunfire unencumbered by 6-foot social distancing. While this was happening, Ahmaud Arbery chased down and murdered in Georgia by white supremacists. The police called on Christian Cooper for simply watching birds in Central Park. George Floyd murdered by police, crying out for breath, for life, for his dead mother. A few nights before, a peaceful protest had descended into chaos in the downtown Chicago night. The unrest spread to the neighborhoods, neighborhoods like ours. The sound of gunshots, day and night, helicopters circling, the smell of smoke as buildings burn, people running past the house with bags of merchandise, a blend of protest and looting, lines between the two blurred and perhaps not even real. But on this morning, I can't get out of my head. He called for his dead mama. This shatters me on this hot South Side morning, hungover again after a night on this same porch drinking wine. But it isn't just this. I'm crying happy tears, too. For stolen moments of joy in this desperate time, for the protests spreading across the globe, for the recognition of valuing of Black lives even among white people, for the opportunity to hold my wife and children. It is 7 o'clock in the morning, and I'm sitting on my front porch on the South Side of Chicago, crying. Helicopters are hovering over my house, the smell of burning storefronts wafting in the humid air. People are running past the house with bags of stuff. I'm crying for these reasons and more, because I love my wife more than any petty argument born of 15 years of struggle, because my children must be taught to live in this awful world in which they can be murdered because of their skin color, because my oldest daughter had a period and she came to us smiling without shame, because there are people tearing down statues downtown, marching in Salt Lake City, painting murals for George Floyd in Paris, the man who called for his dead mother. And I know this. Most of the world's problems could be solved if we simply taught our sons that it's okay to cry, to feel. The world is filled with struggle and suffering. Our problems, the personal and the global, often seem too big to overcome. But we have to feel. We have to resist the temptation to numb ourselves. We have to learn to cry. Erica J. Kendrick is an acclaimed author, national speaker, and a mental fitness expert. She earned a psychology degree from Stanford University and an MBA in marketing and international business from the University of Illinois. Erica was an NBA cheerleader for the Chicago Bulls before writing her novels, Confessions of a Rookie Cheerleader and Appetite. She recently signed a major book deal for her children's novel, Squad Goals, with Little Brown Publishing, due out in spring 2021. While at Stanford, Erica walked suicide's tightrope and was diagnosed with bipolar disorder and acute clinical depression. She was immediately admitted into the psychiatric ward and placed under suicide watch. After years of battling her mental health monsters, Erica founded Mental Fitness for Life, where she launched her latest mental fitness book tour, Who Moved My Happy? While talking to audiences of all backgrounds and ages, Erica shares her story of brain pain and suicide survival while inspiring hope by creating safe spaces for life-saving conversations. She's presented and guest lectured at colleges and universities, as well as the U.S. Army and U.S. Air Force, national sororities and fraternities, middle and high schools, conferences, retreats, and national organizations, large and small. Erica has toured with the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention and is a speaker with the National Alliance on Mental Illness, where she has been inducted into their Hall of Fame. The celebrated author is currently touring her mental fitness workbook, Who Moved My Happy? A go-to guide for discovering your happy and winning at the game of life. Erica is the recipient of several Who's Who honors, a rising icon honor, and several awards of excellence. Erica has taken the stage for TEDx, appeared on the Wendy Williams Experience, national television radio segments, and host of other media outlets. She has been featured in several publications, including Page Six of the New York Post, the Huffington Post, the Chicago Tribune, and various other magazines and digital media. Erica, welcome to Reimagining.
Thanks for having me. I'm honored. I've been looking forward to this conversation. Very necessary. So thanks.
Well, thank you again for being here. So I think that one of the reasons I wanted to invite you on in particular is because it feels to me like among the many crises that we find ourselves in at this moment, global pandemic, an ecological crisis, and many other things going on kind of with unrest in the streets, it feels to me like there is also at the same time a mental health crisis. There's a feeling that people are losing their sense of place and really becoming kind of unmoored and lost in the world right now. And there's always a good time to focus on our mental health, but perhaps now more than ever. I really thought that your work was something that was really important to bring to the program. We alluded to it a little bit in the bio, but talk a little bit about maybe how you came to your own story, came into this work in mental health awareness.
Yeah, definitely. I was one of those people who had to walk through the trenches and make it out on the other side in order to illuminate the path for others. And so when I was at Stanford as a sophomore, I attempted suicide, and I'd been struggling with what I call my mental monsters because I didn't really have the language to articulate my experience with my mental health and the world around me. And I could remember as far back as third grade when a voice in my head told me to jump out of Sister Joyce's second story classroom window, and I listened and I did. So I'd been grappling for a long time, but when I was a sophomore, I attempted, and my mom had to fly out to California and bring me back, where I was placed in the psychiatric ward under suicide watch for the first time and diagnosed with severe acute clinical depression. And then 4 years after that, I was diagnosed with bipolar disorder when I attempted suicide again and was given serious treatment. And it wasn't until I was probably working on my seventh or eighth plan to in my life that I started to take my recovery seriously, or what I call my long-term management plan seriously. I was cheering for the Chicago Bulls, and the voice in my head told me to do something to hurt someone else. And I'd never experienced that before. I'd become very comfortable with the idea of ending my life or hurting myself, but never someone else. And so that was a big wake-up call for me. One of many, but the first one that I took seriously. So I spent about 10 years after that living in New York City, writing novels, doing book tours, you name it. And I was designing essentially what I called my mental fitness plan later. And I had to figure out how to navigate the sticky of my life without medication, because no meds had worked up to that point. Medication therapy wasn't successful with me until much later in my life. So I had to figure it out, and I wanted to thrive and not just struggle to survive. And by the time I'd really gotten what I call my mental fitness plan down, I was able to begin to speak to others about what I'd experienced and how I was able to come out on the other side. And then I got an opportunity to tour with the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, the state of California. And so I popped up in a bunch of towns and cities from Frisco down to San Diego and everything in between, and shared my story. And a lot of folks would ask me the same question. I mean, there'd be audiences of thousands, and there'd be at least 60, 70 people asking me, how are you a Stanford graduate with an MBA and a successful published author, and yet you have serious bipolar disorder with psychosis and grapple with depression and also now anxiety? How is that possible? That doesn't sound like it would be aligned in any way, shape, or form. And I find myself, I tell them, you know, that over and over, there are 10 things that I have to do. You know, I've got to do this and do this and do. And so after a while, I said, you know, I'm going to develop a little pamphlet so they can take away and get the answers to their questions. And that turned into a full workbook. And so with that came a book tour and then more opportunities to speak in front of audiences. And Black and brown folks said, you know, you're in front of thousands of white people, but, you know, what about us? And we don't have programming, and we don't have budgets, and we don't have platforms. And, you know, we need your voice. And that's how Who Moved My Happy began. And so I've been touring during this work, doing this work for all kinds of audiences, but I make a concerted effort to have this conversation with Black and brown folks and share my story, a workshop, Who Moved My Happy, let them know that the workbook is available for any and everyone, while I'm also touring for big clients like the Army and the Air Force, speaking on their bases and doing events for the women's veterans conferences and colleges and universities and conferences and summits across the country as well. So I had to go through it. I had to come out on the other side. And the one thing that was missing was someone who looked like me to tell other folks who looked like me that A, it's okay to not be okay, but B, there's an absolute way to get back to okay.
Yeah. So let's back up a little bit then, because you alluded to a few different obstacles that you and others find in terms of really kind of coming to terms with or being willing to be, to think about mental health as something that is important, not only important, but that, you know, it's not something that's kind of shameful or shouldn't be talked about. So what, talk a little bit about, if maybe in your own story and then in others, like, you know, if you can go back, you alluded to experiences even as a child. I mean, did you feel like you could talk about what was going on with you, you know, when you were younger or even as a young adult? And what were the kind of some of the obstacles you faced in terms of really coming to terms with what was going on with you?
Yeah, so that's a heavy question. And the answer is pretty direct. I did not feel comfortable talking about what I was experiencing. I had a lot of the traditional signs and symptoms of severe depression, including but not limited to not being able to eat or overeating, not sleeping for days on end, just sleeping 13, 14 hours a day, isolating myself from people that I really enjoyed being around and not engaging in the activities that would bring me authentic joy, as well as crying excessively. And when I'd get caught in my room with the door closed crying and my dad would say, baby, what's the problem? And all I could say was, it hurts. And he'd say, well, what? And I'd just say it, you know, on the inside, deep down, yeah. It hurts. So I didn't have language, but I also was embarrassed. Stigma was very pervasive in Black and Brown communities when I was initially diagnosed, and it made it incredibly difficult to learn about what this thing was and accept that I was someone who would have to face it for the rest of my life, but then to educate others or have conversations just around what this thing was and what it was doing to me at that point was nearly impossible. I feared judgment. I feared consternation. I feared what I would think of myself if I wholly accepted that I was mentally ill. Would that mean that I was the C word, you know, crazy? Mm-hmm. And it was very challenging. It still is because of stigma for people, not for me. I mean, obviously I make this my life's work because sure. The reality is that, and this is what I share with audiences of all ages and populations, the brain is an organ. And just like your kidneys or your heart or your liver, it can get sick, but it can also get better too with proper intervention. And the brain is the most vital organ in our body. And it only makes sense that we give it more care than we would anything else in our systems. And so when I kind of frame it that way, folks kind of step back and say, whoa, okay, I never considered it from a biological perspective. I'm looking at it from a sociological one. And the perception I think that folks would have if I came out and admitted that I was struggling with a mental illness relative to, you know, whatever their experience is. So yeah, it was really difficult and challenging. I embraced the stigma, swallowed it whole. And I've gotten to the point where I spit it back out. And, you know, the goal is to normalize mental health and normalize mental health challenges while stomping out the stigma.
Yeah. The stigma thing. I mean, what kind of things do people say to you? I mean, do you get the kind of suck it up sort of?
Yeah. Not anymore. Yeah. Not anymore. I would dare somebody to say that to me today.
Yeah.
But I heard everything from snap out of it to shake it off to pull up your big girl panties. We've got work to do.
Right.
And then on the other extreme, I heard, you know, you're a rock star. You know, you can't be suffering with a mental illness, not you. There's no way you would have been able to graduate Stanford or St. Ignatius or be class president or you couldn't do that if you were sick. There's nothing wrong with you. And oftentimes the truth is, and this is something that younger folks can relate to, When you can't see an illness or a disability, then it makes it harder to swallow that you're dealing with it or for others to accept that you're having this massive challenge in your world. And mental illness, a lot of it is not something that you can see. Now, schizophrenia is one extreme that you can absolutely see visibly when folks are interacting with space and time around them that others can't see or experience. That looks abnormal.
Sure,
but depression, being down or being sad, you know, you can't see that on someone because we all experience sadness. So there's no way to really differentiate that from just having a bad day. And then anxiety is something we all experience, but when it's debilitating, it's hard to also differentiate that from just, you know, needing to shake it off or get over it or pray about it or come to grandma's on Sunday for a good meal and you'll feel better or sleep it off. So
yeah.
Those are very real things that I've experienced from other people.
I mean, anxiety, you know, it's interesting you brought that up. I think it feels to me like anxiety is, and I've read this, that anxiety is increasingly a problem, especially with young people. And even we use the word depression or a lot of these words, we use them sort of in a flippant kind of way, you know, and talk about these things as though they're not diagnoses, but just sort of like a way you're feeling at a moment. And they can be that, and there's certainly some gray area, but anxiety is something that's being diagnosed more and more and seems like it's more and more of an issue in our world today.
Well, we've got a lot of stimuli that we haven't had in the last decade or so. And with that comes an inability to focus and concentrate. And then we get into areas of high distractibility. And as a result, anxiety becomes more and more common. And then with conversation around connectivity, oh, this is what I'm going through. Oh, me too. Then folks are more apt to say, all right, I need to tell someone. I need to reach out and get some support for this because, you know, the bottom line with a mental health challenge is it's starting to impact my daily functioning. And it's doing that in a way that's lasted longer than 2 weeks. And so with the increased stimuli and the connectivity between folks who are going through the same thing through the shared experience, anxiety is one of those conditions that is becoming more and more prevalent as a diagnosis, at least.
I want to talk a little bit about, you know, from my own perspective, talking about the stigma as a man who times, like we all do, has to deal with my mental health, right? And I'd like you to talk a little bit about, you've worked in a variety of different settings with a variety of different people. I'd like you to talk a little bit about maybe how that stigma kind of plays out for men in particular, and how what you hear as far as the challenges for men in terms of addressing their own mental health. I mean, I can speak from my own experience that I never had therapy or felt like I needed therapy till I was well into my 40s, and surely could have used therapy long before then. And I think some of it had to do with this sort of notion that, you know, as a man, you're supposed to sort of suck it up. Would you kind of talk a little bit about that kind of?
I mean, you hit it on the head. That's what I hear from the majority of men that want to have confidential conversations with me around mental illness or mental health challenges that they may be experiencing. There's some machismo factor that plays heavily into admitting that you don't have control over something that's happening with you. And that inhibits a lot of men from saying, all right, I need some support over here. Historically, men and men of color have been, there's this brooding, I've got the ability to take it all on and I'm not weak, and this is my symbol of strength, the fact that I can endure. And, you know, that's just problematic when we're talking about the idea that statistically one in four people, humans in our country, is dealing with a mental health challenge right this moment. That's one in four. And Black and brown folks don't report. So the numbers are actually a lot higher than that. I would imagine probably one in two. Every other person is dealing with some sort of mental health challenge, and the spectrum is vast. But I mean, if that's our reality and that's data from the Census Bureau, then the truth is that it's problematic for men, particularly men of color, to not reach out and ask for the support that they need because of a stigma and because of the historical implications of putting yourself in front of practitioners and giving them the power to kind of control your trajectory. We've seen that go down historically in ways that we don't want to address again, or we definitely don't want to experience again. And within the realms of psychiatry, it's been no different. In the 70s, psychiatrists labeled Black men as aggressive relative to schizophrenia. And historically, Black men now get that diagnosis almost twice as much as white men do, with no scientific basis for it. So just historically, there's a lot of nuance there when it comes to men saying, hey, I need some support from a trained clinician, you know, whatever that may look like. But when we're talking about mental health, then that hits a whole other realm. And we have to be very careful how we address that, because like I said, it's problematic as the numbers continue to rise, particularly during this era, and suicide is on the rise. So we've got to really be careful with that. Another thing I always hear is that Black men are afraid if they do fall apart, that instead of being placed in a facility where they can get the help that they actually need, they're going to be placed in prison. And, you know, that's also been the case for decades. So it's a very touchy subject, but it cannot go unchallenged. It just cannot.
Yeah, I mean, I think those historical and kind of societal and sociological reasons for that skepticism are legitimate. You know, I think the rates of mental illness in our prisons is astronomical. And we know that the rates of incarceration for Black and brown men are astronomical. So certainly reason for that kind of skepticism, given all the historical and current issues there. I want to back up too a little bit about the thing about men a little bit. And I think this applies to women and girls as well, but I think it's particularly pervasive for men, in that going back to kind of the way we raise our children, and this I think covers a lot of different people, but the way in which I think sometimes we raise our boys not to be okay with being vulnerable, how that can actually increase a person's need for mental health services and also increase the resistance to getting those mental health services later, I think.
Yeah, so we don't socialize our children in our communities to embrace, to understand, and then to embrace just the whole idea of mental health. When I tour in white areas, I'll be talking to high schoolers or sometimes middle schoolers, and they'll tell me that they've had a life coach since they were 7.
Oh, wow.
When we talk about disparity, it's mind-blowing to think that our children do not understand signs, symptoms, treatment options of depression, of anxiety, of post-traumatic stress disorder, which a lot of our children are dealing with coming out of underserved, underrepresented communities. It's generational, number one. You know, it's all about how we're socialized. But beyond that, once the conversation begins to happen around us, we need to listen. And what I experience a lot are younger Black and brown children saying, that doesn't apply to me. My family goes to church for that. Jesus will handle it. Jesus will protect me. God will take that away from me. I've been on radio stations and callers have called to tell me that I had demons inside of me. One woman wanted to do an exorcism on me. And so there are a lot of cultural factors that play into our young people, particularly our young boys, being able to say, hey, I need support. But I will be honest, there are, I think probably for the first time historically since the community resource centers for mental health have begun to close in our communities, I think for the first time in a long time, there are programs popping up dealing specifically with the trauma that young Black men face so that they don't have this massive propensity to develop mental health issues later as a direct result of that trauma. Right, and so I see this happening in various communities around the country. Now, where they're getting the funding from, I'm not quite sure, but I'm hopeful that in November, things will take a turn for the better and we'll be able to get the kinds of capital into the communities to reestablish those community centers that were actively dedicated to providing mental health resources and access to folks who need it, especially our young children, especially our young boys.
Yeah. So let's talk a little about that context that you referred to. When we talk about mental health, it's complex because there are environmental factors that can impact a person's mental health. And then there are also biological factors as well. Yeah. So in that sense, anyone can suffer from mental health crisis, regardless of their situation. But I also wanted to directly point to some of the ways in which there are in certain places, in certain communities, in certain circumstances, there is a mental health crisis that is the result of trauma in the community. So particularly in Chicago, where you're from and where I'm based, we see a lot of trauma resulting from pervasive violence and poverty and systemic racism. Can you talk a little bit about kind of like how you see those kind of systemic or societal factors impacting the community in terms of mental health?
Yeah, so I'm an ambassador, a speaker for the National Alliance on Mental Illness. And one of the partnerships that we have is with the Chicago Public School District. So during the school year, I'm in classrooms all over the city. And when I tell you that the trauma that the children are experiencing in the communities is being brought into their worlds on a holistic level, I would not be lying. From leaving the house to going into the classroom, lunch, trying to get back home after school, dealing with the rampant violence and the discrimination, the police brutality, gang violence, it's very, very real. I've had children come up to me and say, I just watched my best friend get shot in the head this week, right? And and I'm here. And I've got all this stuff inside of me and I don't know what to do with it. That alone is powerful, that a kid can just articulate that much. But without the proper intervention, and we're talking about schools, because this is where our kids spend the majority of their day.
Right.
The pandemic has shoved that in everyone's faces. Also made it clear that communities of color have disparities with access and treatment and care, with diagnoses. And this is a historical, cultural, political issue. It's not about being Black or being white or being Latino. This is, and it's very real. And so the second part of that point I want to make is that I go to the schools and they have one social worker for a huge high school. And that social worker, her time is divided between 7 or 8 other schools. That's absolutely horrendous, because that same kid who just watched his best friend get shot in the head, whether it be by a gang member or the police officer, has to deal with what he's experienced. And the way to deal with that currently, the setup is in school with a social worker, because a lot of these kids don't have access in the community to walk into a therapeutic center. They don't have a general practitioner that can refer them to a therapist or a psychologist or a psychiatrist to get, you know, medical intervention if that's necessary to balance them out until they can get into a group setting or long-term one-on-one therapy with a trained clinician. I mean, these resources are not available.
Right.
I mean, they're just not. I've seen it. I can't speak for other cities, although I know that Chicago is not an exception in this regard.
Right.
I'm in these schools left and right, I mean, almost weekly. And the reality is that the trauma experienced in the community is a direct precursor to these children dealing with post-traumatic stress disorder. But then it also has longer legs, and that can manifest itself in anxiety, in depression, in mania, all of which are, according to the DSM-5, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual on Mental illnesses or mental disorders, those are legitimate mental illnesses. And in that regard, it is absolutely environmental. But I told you the statistic for how many folks are currently dealing with a mental health challenge, 1 in 4. So a lot of those kids already have a genetic predisposition to a mental health disorder. So you put that on top of the environment, and that trauma can literally spiral into something that could be tragic or fatal for them.
Yeah. It's certainly been my observation, you know, working with young people in Chicago with the Chicago Wisdom Project, that, you know, we sometimes would work with young people who would come to us, and they're constantly berated about how they've made all these poor choices, and that's why they're getting in trouble and this, that, and the other thing. And there's kind of a heavy emphasis on getting young people the skills that they need for jobs or for school. And that's obviously important. But the observation that I've made working with a lot of groups of young people is that the biggest challenge is that trauma. And it's not at all about choices they've made. It's just about their circumstances and things far beyond their control. And sometimes what we perceive as bad choices are sometimes the only choices that they feel like they can have.
That's
in context, you know what I mean? To survive mentally and emotionally.
That's right.
What's your feeling about how the pandemic is affecting people in terms of mental health? It feels to me like this is a really hard time for a lot of people because we're not just the sort of anxiety about what's going to happen next, but just being kind of stuck inside and not being able to move around. And some people are very isolated. Like, what do you think about the pandemic and its impact?
Yeah, you just named off like four or five
right.
Very real challenges that folks are up against right now. I do a lot of virtual speaking, obviously because of COVID, and the questions that I get in the chat comments is always the same. How can I cope? How can I deal with the isolation? How can I deal with the loneliness? How can I deal with the feelings of helplessness and hopelessness? All of those are symptoms of severe depression, chronic depression, if they last longer than 2 weeks. And we know, hell, we were quarantined and the city was shut down for 3 months. So that's definitely longer than 2 weeks. But the reality is that it's debilitating for a lot of people. It's become our new norm because with time, things become normalized. And so we've adjusted to it. It doesn't lessen the effects that folks are feeling as a result of not having social contact, as a result of feeling like they don't have absolute control over their everyday. The idea that walking down the street can infect you with a killer virus creates in a lot of us a substantial amount of anxiety that we can only shake by going back in the house and disinfecting everything with Lysol. That's no way to live. But
I was going to say we've evolved to be social animals and to touch each other and to require that kind of human connection, and to think that in a few weeks we can adjust to that and be, you know, in any way kind of mentally healthy is I think pretty unrealistic.
Absolutely. When we're talking about, to piggyback on that, just general self-care, it becomes that much more challenging to implement that into our everyday. So many of us are, if we're exercising, and I'll put if out there pre-pandemic, then the gym's closed. So how do we now get our exercise? And is it okay to go outside and take a jog or a bike ride? Okay, do I wear a mask when I do that? Okay, am I putting other people at risk because I'm jogging down the street? Okay, maybe I don't do that. Okay, I got to find a video on cable where they're doing a step routine with the step master or a dance cardio workout video. I mean, it's flipped everything on its head, but that's just, all right, now we're talking about exercising, which is vital for overall wellness. Then we talk about what we put into our bodies. And folks were for a long time afraid to go to the grocery store because they didn't know if those close quarters up and down the aisles were going to have a negative impact on their well-being. Okay, so then we do start grocery shopping regularly. Okay, we've got that down. But I'm really feeling like I want to eat comfort food because that's what I need to get me through these moments. And this quarantine 15 is not a figment of our imagination. So many people have reached out to me and said, I need to get the workbook because I really need to focus on the sleeping, the exercising, and the eating chapters. I've gained this weight. I know why I've gained it. It's because I'm all day in the house on Zoom calls, and I'm grabbing what's right there to comfort me through the day and into the evening. So those two realities alone, what we're eating and lack of exercise or having to re-envision or reimagine how we're exercising, has been a vital touch point for folks who want to ensure that their wellness stays intact. And those are just two of a myriad of things that are impacting us because of the pandemic.
Yeah, you've kind of touched on a few ways to give yourself mental kind of fitness support. And I want to get more into your approach in a minute. We're going to take a quick break first.
Okay.
Our statement of intent. One, the planet and humanity are at a moment of crisis and opportunity and of transition. Two, because we are entering into an unknown future, imagination is paramount. Three, this moment requires new stories, new narratives, new creative works that express this reimagining. Four, we believe that these narratives must challenge and confront the injustices of our day. Five, crisis of the moment is an educational crisis. That is, we must reimagine educational processes in order to reimagine our narratives. Six, we welcome educators, poets, philosophers, activists, and writers who are interested in reimagining ourselves and our relationship to the planet. Seven, reimagining is a place not so much to find quick answers or definitive solutions. Rather, it is a place to ask big questions, to explore possibilities, and to imagine a new world. You can find more about our work at www.reimaginingmagazine.com and more about our broader mission at www.chicagowisdomproject.org and www.baltimorewisdomproject.org.
Welcome back to Reimagining. I'm talking with Erica Kendrick today about reimagining mental health. Erica, I wanted to kind of get more into your actual approach and how you, you know, without giving away the whole book, but how do you approach mental health? What's your way of kind of getting people, once you've convinced them that there's a need there? Talk a little bit about your approach to mental health fitness and what you mean by fitness, I guess, too.
Yeah. So one thing that I learned early on with myself, as I began to have conversations with people around what I was experiencing when I was younger, is that language is very powerful. Mm-hmm. Language really matters. And so when I say mental health, when I say mental illness, folks in the community, they lean back. Whoa, yeah. There's a lot of pushback there. Wait a minute now. Hold on. Now you're talking about something that's very taboo. Are you saying that I have a mental illness? Are you, now I could be talking about myself, but they immediately get defensive and there's a wall that goes up. When I say mental health, okay, I kind of know what that is. Okay, that's a little gray, but I'm halfway listening to you. But when I say mental fitness, they lean in. Ooh, That sounds sexy. What's that? And we're already so accustomed to hearing physical fitness since we were, you know, in gym class. Mental fitness doesn't sound like too far of a stretch for folks to kind of grasp and digest. So that's where mental fitness for me, the phrase was coined. And especially as I was talking to younger folks, they loved it. So that's that. How do I approach it? My approach is a holistic one. I don't believe in one size fits all. For some folks, having a diagnosis may mean that they need just group support, and maybe that's once a week and that works for them. For other folks, it could mean CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, where they sit down with a trained clinician and they kind of pull back the layers of who they are to figure out how to fit the circle of them into the square of life. And for other folks, it could mean medication therapy. And then for some other folks, it could mean a combination of all of the above. So the way I approach it is, I need for wellness to be psychological, yes, so that you're dealing with your issues, whether that be trauma from growing up. It could be something as severe as you having been raped and never having dealt with that, and now that's showing up in your relationships with folks. It could be something as small as just generalized anxiety that pops up every once in a while. And then it could be everything in between. And so what I came up with for myself when I was not on medication were 10 ways, 10 things that I had to do. I call them the Incredible 10. And if I did them consistently, I was ensured that I could stay in my happy. There was no way around it. There was no doubt about it. But part of those 10 includes therapy for me. And now, many, many years later, after having done several trial and error cycles with medication, all these years later, I'm on medication again. And I found one pill that works for me. I take a small dosage of a bipolar med once a day in the evening, and it has been a complete game changer for me. I can't imagine life without it, and I will be on it for the rest of my life. And that's just my reality. So part of the Incredible 10 for me looks like therapy, which also looks like a psychiatrist who then prescribes my little magic pill. But I am completely invested in folks being able to micromanage their own mental fitness plans. And so a great degree of it needs to be free. It needs to be accessible. It needs to be manageable. Realistically, it needs to be quantifiable, and folks need to be able to be held accountable. So in the workbook, I go through the 10 steps that start with the most important thing, I think, is having a dynamic support squad. I call it your VIP support squad. And my therapist is part of that support squad, definitely. And then the second chapter lends itself to therapy. And I equate therapy to dating. And, you know, you may not find that perfect therapist on the first try. And that's when a lot of folks that I've talked to give up. They say, this just isn't for me. This isn't a good fit for my life. And I say, yeah, but if you were dating and you went on one bad date, I refuse to believe that you would never go find another Heidi to go out with. I just refuse. Right. And they start laughing. And it's like, well, no, of course not. Of course I'm going to keep dating. Well, then keep trying to find your therapist. Approach it the same way. Do the screening interview over the phone like you would before a date. Have your list of questions ready for the first date, your first meeting with your therapist. Have your follow-up questions ready when you've gone on the date and then you talk on the phone after that. Be prepared to have a second date and feel that out. And so there's a whole mindset that I set around therapy and finding a therapist. I hold your hand and take you through that process, because so many of us have all these television and movie ideas about what therapy actually looks like. And to be honest, it could look like a variety of things. I have a good friend who's a therapist, and he takes his clients for walks on the beach in LA, and that's their session. I have another one who deals with boys, and they go out for pizza and then they shoot basketball. Therapy can look a lot of different ways. And so it's important to have that in the workbook. But then there are things like clean eating and exercising, meditating, visualizing, and some other really powerful tools that I teach you. I hold you accountable with it. And because it's what I would have created for the younger version of me, I also put my story in there. So it's also part memoir. My favorite part is in the back, I have a section called brain pain disorders. And I love it because according to the National Alliance on Mental Illness, I've targeted the top four most common mental illnesses or mental health challenges and what their signs and symptoms are and treatment options. So folks can begin to engage with that language, and it's not meant to have them self-diagnose, but absolutely to become familiar with what a mental illness can look like and then say, hey, maybe I need to talk to my general practitioner or my nurse or the school counselor, because I've been experiencing some of this stuff right here and I want to talk about this over here, treatment options, how can I get better? So that's probably my favorite part of the book. And then the journal pages with self-starting questions or little phrases to help you kind of get motivated and write out different things. So that's my approach to mental fitness. It should be fun. It should be challenging, because anytime you are working to better yourself, especially in a world where we are actively discriminated against and been told that we're less than because of the color of our skin, and that alone is stressful and traumatizing, engaging with work like the workbook and the pages throughout is meant to uplift you. It's meant to take all of that stress off of you and to realize that you do have the power to move forward and shift the trajectory of your wellness. That's why the workbook and the tour and the brand is called Who Moved My Happy, because ultimately, once you get into it, you realize no one moved it. It's in you, but you just got to do the work to kind of hone it and then get it anchored in something that's sustainable, and that's your wellness.
Yeah, I really like the framing of fitness. It shifts it away from kind of the pathology, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a lot of stigma with that notion of mental illness, obviously. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think that we've all got to work on our mental health fitness, just like our physical fitness. And even the physical fitness is related, because you're taking a holistic approach, which is also important. I think that thinking about fitness means the whole person has to be healthy. And if we focus only on the illness part, there's a tendency to want to, you know, kind of fix it with a pill. And right. which is a pervasive kind of approach in our society, just take a pill and it'll go away, rather than think about all of the different factors we have in our lives, you know, and the pill can be part of it, like it is for you, but it can't be the only part of it.
Absolutely. I mean, if you think about it, if you're trying to lose weight and you watch every commercial that's targeted at the consumers for weight loss, it's about take this pill, and okay, you take the pill, but the weight doesn't come off. Well, it's not going to come off, because you've got to exercise and you've got to eat better and you've got to do this combination of things to reach your end goal. And it's the exact same thing with mental fitness. If you are one of the people like me who does take meds for whatever your challenge is, that's great, but you've still got to get the proper amount of sleep so your brain and your body can reboot. You still got to surround yourself with folks that aren't toxic, folks that are going to love you unconditionally and hold you accountable. You've still got to exercise. You've still got to, you know, so the way you just put it is perfect. And the sooner that we begin to embrace that idea and adopt that mindset, the faster we'll be able to move toward a wellness and to ensuring we're happy. Yeah, things are hard, but they're not going to be hopeless moving forward. Not if I have anything to do with it.
Yeah, it's a great way to sort of head us towards the finish line here. I wanted to, you know, at the end, we usually talk about this question of reimagining. So if you could sort of reimagine together with me about what would say you really, you know, if you look at our communities and individuals and how we're living now, what is your vision for a healthier, a mentally healthier world or mentally healthier communities? What would you like to see happen in your community or in the world at large to help people enhance their mental fitness?
Well, I'm a huge proponent. That's a beautiful question. I'm a huge proponent of education. So when I tour and I get up on stage and I do my thing, I'm educating, but I'm also entertaining because it's funny and it's raw and it's real. And I have to laugh at a lot of the stuff that I talk about. But the first thing is education. So for me, what it would look like is having a mental fitness curriculum in all of the schools, all across our country, all across the globe. And at the first touch point in daycare, kindergarten, the literature and language has been customized for that demographic, but they are engaging with language and with a holistic understanding of what mental fitness is, how it impacts them, what does it look like, how do they help others, how do they identify in others as well as themselves. And as they progress through school, obviously the curriculum gets broader and more in-depth, a little heavier, more weighted, and this stays with them through college. For me, when I reimagine mental fitness in our community as humans, that's what I see. So maybe 4 years ago, about 4.5 years ago, I developed a mental fitness curriculum and I piloted it in a high school in Los Angeles, a 4-week program, and the data was through the roof. It's a fantastic program. I don't know if other folks have been doing that work, but I see those kinds of programs in schools across the country because ideally, what I want is for a young person who turns into an older person to, at any span of their lifetime, be able to say, I'm not okay. And I need to get some help, some support so that I can be okay. That's it. That's the bottom line. There's no gray area and it's not rocket science. And the only way that we can, as humans, say, hey, I'm not okay, is if we understand we've been educated around what not being okay looks like. And what is that language to articulate that to someone who can help me and then work toward getting back to being okay? That's what me reimagining mental fitness or mental health in our human community would look like.
That's beautiful. That's beautiful. Erica Kendrick, thank you so much for joining us in Reimagining.
You're so welcome. It's been an honor and a pleasure. Thank you for having me. I'm a fan.
Thank you.
The Reimagining Podcast with Theodore Richards is a production of Wisdom Projects Incorporated. Original music by Cosmos Ray. Sound engineering by Jim Qualick. Thank you for listening and for reimagining with us.